Hello. In this audio snippet, we will attempt to talk a little bit about the 1876 presidential election in the context of Black America and the post-Civil War period. But before getting to that, there was just one thing that I felt the need to mention, something that wasn't mentioned in the previous audio snippet. And it had to do with something that I saw on or heard on television. One day I was flipping through the channels and I saw and I went through a Christian channel that I rarely watch, especially because the signal is very weak. And I don't have cable, so I have to depend on broadcast signal. So usually I don't pick it up, but I don't miss it either because I really couldn't care less for it most of the time. But that day the signal came in, and I would have normally continued flipping through it, but I saw that there was this Christian preacher. I don't know his name, and again, I couldn't care less, but for some reason he drew my attention. I just felt the need, like, to listen to him for a short while. Like, I had to listen to him because there was something interesting that I had to hear. I don't know why I had to stop and listen. And he was preaching, and I think he was preaching on something about I think he was preaching from the Book of Matthew or something like that, and it had to do with I think it when it says there that you can't serve two masters, God and Mammon, something to that effect. And he was going on and on about it. It felt like he was going on and on. It was very brief, the amount of time that I listened, but it felt long. But I was curious, like, where is he going? What is he going to do with that passage? And for some reason, some of the things he said, which I don't quite recall, sounded interesting. Like, there was some substance to it. Usually with Christian preachers, it's usually just fluff. They just preach fluffiness. But there were some things of interest, things that seemed to have a little bit of substance. And then he said something that drew my attention. He said, Mammon is a spirit. And I said, wow. I said to myself, well, interesting. I had never heard anyone say that. Maybe it's a common thing, but I had never heard of that. Like, Mammon is a spirit. And okay, where is he going with this? Okay, and then he said, and if you doubt that it's a spirit, how come it talks? I said, okay, and then he said, for example, when you're about to donate, give your offering or your tithe. Why does this mammon start telling you, why are you giving that money away? And the moment he said that, I said, okay, this is why I had to listen to him, and that turned him off. So basically, he was saying, you know, mammon is a spirit. So he was giving it like a life. It was a spirit, and then he said, well, the spirit, I know it's a spirit because it talks. And what has that spirit said? And then he gave, quote, an example. When you're about to give an offering, obviously, to his church or his ministry, because he was preaching to the congregation, you know, that he, quote, pastors. They always talk about tithes and offerings in general, but you know, obviously when they're speaking to their audience, they're saying tithing and offerings to their ministry, naturally. So the thing is, he was saying, when you're about to give an offering to our ministry, you hear a voice saying, "Why are you giving that money away? Why are you not sowing? You know, that thing that they love to talk, you know, the sowing thing, you know, sow $1,000 into our ministry and you will reap a harvest and blah, blah, blah." And I turned it off immediately and I said to myself, oh, interesting irony, because he was talking about, not being faithful to God because you're faithful to mammon, or you're obsessed with mammon more than worrying about God. But the irony is that he himself manifested the spirits. Like I said to myself after that, well, yeah, I guess it is a spirit because, and it talks. And I just heard it say something out of the mouth of that same preacher, because he was promoting using that teaching in the Bible to get people to give money to him because he's worried about mammon. So the very man who is decrying the spirit of mammon was allowing the spirit of mammon to speak through him to get people to give mammon to his ministry. And I was so disappointed, but not surprised. But, you know, for example, you were a fan of the Cleveland Browns, you know, back in the day, but not back in the days of the runner, I forget his name, oh, Jim Brown. I'm talking about after Jim Brown, when the Cleveland Browns couldn't win anything if it was handed to them on a silver platter. You knew they were going to lose every Sunday, so you were disappointed, but you would watch and lose and still be disappointed, even though you knew they were not going to win. That's the sort of feeling that I had after watching this man. And it kind of saddened me because the concept of mammon, if you look at the root of it, the word in the Greek has, and I thought he was maybe going in that direction, going into like a deeper message about things. But he didn't. He stayed at the surface level. He used it as an opportunity to preach to people, to give money to his ministry. But the word mammon has an underlying meaning. If you look at it in the Greek in the original Greek word, and it has the connotation of something to which you tie your identity. So the deeper concept of mammon is this idea of attaching your identity to an external thing, and that applies to the attitude that people have, where they say, you know, I am a, you know, fill in the blank, you know, some ethnicity, some race, and then they say that's who I am. So they're saying my identity, you know, who I am, is intrinsically tied to my ethnicity, to my race. So therefore, if anyone criticizes my race, they're criticizing me because my identity is tied to that race. It's like you're putting your identity deposit in the ethnicity bank. So if you happen to be black, then you're putting all your money, identity money, your mammon, in a sense, you're putting your identity money in a black bank. So if anyone says anything bad about black bank, they are basically attacking your deposit, and because your money is there. So if they're saying that bank is no good or has a lot of problems, then they're saying you put your money in the wrong bank. So it's kind of a little bit like that. And that's why it becomes difficult to criticize races or attitudes, racial attitudes. As we've said a million times, races are, at the end of the day, nothing more than families. And they're good families and they're bad families. Now, if you're born into a bad family, I mean, that doesn't make you bad. And And you should have the freedom to divorce yourself from that family. Just like, as we've explained a million times before, if you are born into a mafia family, it's not your fault that your whole family is doing mafia stuff. I mean, you didn't get a choice, I guess, to be born into that mafia family. Maybe you did in a certain way. Maybe not, I don't know. But the thing is, once you're there, and you can't control what your family does, but you can decide whether or not you agree with it. And that's the thing with families. People are born into families, and they are surrounded by certain attitudes. And then when they reach a certain conscious age, they start having this choice to make. Do I absorb these family values and make them my own, or do I reject them? And that's why sometimes families have these people, you know, the so-called black sheep, the people who seem to disagree with the rest of the family's value system. But it's a choice you make. And if you embrace the family, then whatever the family does is also to be made accountable to you. Like, you are accountable for your family the moment you attach your values to the family's values. But if you choose not to, you can't, even though you were born into the family, it's as if you were not of that family, because you're your own person. And therefore, if my identity is not attached to my race, and that's what serving mammon in the Greek term really means, is when you attach yourself, your identity to something that doesn't have an ultimate value or intrinsic value, where when you attach your identity to something inappropriate. So if my identity is not tied to the race or ethnicity or whatever that I was born into, then I can be my own person, and I can actually be an influence in reshaping what's going on in that race or ethnicity. And I'm not going to get upset when someone says something bad about the race that I was born into or ethnicity that I was born into, because I'll say, yeah, you're right. You know, like a person, a decent person born into a mafia family, if someone says, oh, those mafia people, the Corleones or whatever, going around killing people, you're not going to say, oh, how dare you say that the Corleones are killing people. Well, obviously, if they do it, it's for a good reason, you know, because you feel like they are questioning your identity, your existence, your very essence of being is being attacked. And then you start defending something that's clearly wrong. But if you have a conscience, then you're going to say, yeah, my family, the Corleones, are really, really bad, and they're going around killing people, and it's totally wrong. And then you become an influence in changing the family's values. So that's what serving mammon is all about. That's the message he should have preached or talked about to his dumb audience of sheep. But instead of that, he turned it into a message about giving money to his church. So he was serving mammon just as he was supposedly preaching against it. And if I could be wrong with this, but I think I, if I'm not mistaken, one of the reasons, I could be wrong with this, or I could be confusing it with another incident, but I think one of the reasons that I stayed to listen is because at the bottom of the screen it said Pastor So-and-so, the title, Pastor So-and-so. And it's like, oh, okay, let me see what Pastor So-and-so has to say. And I felt this need to listen to him, because there was a bit of substance to the words he was saying. Like there was something interesting he was about to say. And I guess the thing of most interest was the thing about, oh, this mammon is a spirit. So he said this interesting concept I had never heard before, but from a Christian preacher. But the thing is that his proof, his evidence was, the spirit is telling my sheep not to give money to me. You know, that was his proof. But he should have taken the message to a deeper level. And then said the real thing, you know, something that has substance that would have transformed the thinking of the people who were listening to him. But instead, he left it at a very superficial level. And the reason why I'm telling you all of this is, to me, it was like a confirmation, even deeper confirmation, that the country is dead. This was an American preacher. And as we said before, the American church is dead. It's a matriarchal system run by pastors. Pastors are effeminate, especially when they try to run the show. They are effeminate. They are the people who promote this very wishy-washy, you know, effeminate, quote, Christianity, where you are not allowed to manifest your male personality qualities of judge, because they hate, oh, you should judge, you should just love and serve in the church kitchen and do this and that and the other. They don't like you to be a judge. They don't like you to be a visionary, because a visionary confronts established structures. He sees a vision, he or she sees a vision and starts promoting that vision. And sometimes that vision clashes, or almost all of the time, it clashes with established paradigms and structures and hierarchies and all an organization and structure and all that. So, and they hate that, like, oh, no, don't rock the boat. And the other thing is, the other male personality that we've talked about is the conqueror personality. They don't like that. They like it as long as they can conquer people for their ministry. Like, if someone has a conquering attitude, they use them as the, quote, evangelist to go and get people, conquer people's souls to get them to the congregation. So that's why they love the conquering personality, but only as long as it remains subservient to them. They are servers. They promote the two female personalities, server and organizer. They love people who serve. They love people who sweep, the church floor, or after the meeting, who stack away the foldable chairs, or the people who serve in, you know, the soup kitchen, giving food to the poor, and doing all these charitable things to appear good in front of society and all this stuff. They love all that. And there's nothing wrong with being a server and organizer, but it becomes effeminate when it pretends to be a man or a male quality. When they try to control things, that's when it goes from being female to being effeminate. And that's why you have all these pastors who, I mean, I sometimes feel like touching them is like touching this jelly of a person, you know, like people who are like who are unfortunately have like a fatness problem. But I mean, people who are fat because there's something wrong with their attitude. Like lazy people. That's what I'm referring to. Fat, lazy people who are fat because they just enjoy eating and don't do anything. You know, I'm not talking about other types of fat problems, so please don't misunderstand what I'm trying to say. I'm not criticizing you if you're fat. That's not what I'm going for here, or what I'm trying to say. I'm targeting certain types of fat people. People who are just fat because they're there's some grossness about the fatness, because it's a manifestation of their attitude. They're just laziness. And it's like touching like poking your finger at a body like that. That's what it feels like to these pastors. There's something very like Jabba the Hutt-ish about them. There's a grossness to them, and it's softness. There's a softness, like touching the Pillsbury, like poking the Pillsbury Doughboy. But it's the Pillsbury Doughboy, at least, is cute, and you poke it, and you know that it's the skin is going to bounce back, if you know what I'm trying to say. With them, it's like you poke it, and then it takes a while for the skin to refill the hole, you know, that you created by poking it. You know what I'm trying to say? Because it's so lazy, it doesn't even bounce back. That's what pastors, especially, and I'm referring to, well, pastors around the world, but in particular here, in the context of America, I'm talking about American pastors. That's what they are. That's why they have no character, no manly strength, no, and as I've said, manliness in this context has nothing to do with being male or female. And Margaret Thatcher was manlier than 99.9% of the American pastors. She was a strong woman with strong character and strong leadership in the context of her leadership. As a personal, as a woman on her private side, she was a softer person and all that. But in terms of her leadership, she was manly, and it was a good thing. But these pastors are effeminate, they're soft, they are disgusting. They're disgusting people. And that's why they have no power to do anything in the midst of all the destruction that's going on with the country. Every now and then, one of them rises up and tries to do this semi-effort of fighting for conservative values and American traditions. But when he does it, he's doing it not as a man, but actually as a woman, because the organizers are the ones who promote family values and traditions. And you know, I don't give a rodent's derriere about traditions. If the tradition is stupid, it should be fought against and destroyed. You shouldn't just support something because it's our traditions. No, who the hell cares what our traditions are or are not? What the question is it the truth or is it not the truth? Is it consistent with reality? Is it not consistent with reality? But they try to fight by using tradition as a way to fight back against the system, against the destruction of the country, instead of fighting in terms of truth and saying this is true, this is not true. It's not because you know, and then they start saying, oh, it's, I believe this because it's in the Bible. Well, to someone who doesn't believe the Bible, that statement makes no sense. You know, it makes no sense at all. You see what I'm saying? It's that, oh, so you're saying I have to believe it because it's in the Bible? That's all you have to say about it? And then they prove that they only believe it because they read it, not because they understand it. It's like they have a surface connection with the truth, but they don't have a real intimate connection with the truth. Because when you have a real intimate connection with the truth, when you're saying something, substance is going to come out of your mouth, and people are going to hear you. They may or may not agree with you, but they know they heard substance, and they know that they have heard someone who not only is repeating a truth that they read on a piece of paper or that they were indoctrinated with from childhood, but that they're speaking a truth that they understand, that they embrace, they absorb into their being, and now it's part of them. And it's coming out of them as they're speaking it. And they're expressing the nature of the truth that they're speaking. So it's not just, oh, I... So you're then confronted with the truth on its own merit. Not because it came out of a book or it came out of a of what was taught in your family when you were growing up. But because you believe it. And that's the difference. Some of these preachers do rise up and try to fight what's going on, but they fight in an effeminate way. You know, they start throwing punches like a girl instead of showing power and authority in the way they speak. And they would have that power, that authority, and that deep insight if they embraced, you know, the visionary, the conqueror, and the judge personalities instead of constantly suppressing them. That's why when I saw the, if I am not confusing this with another event, when I saw the word pastor as part of the title, it's like, oh, okay, yeah. This is an effeminate man speaking from an effeminate perspective. The matriarchal perspective that controls the church, and that's why it's so powerless to change things, and that's why the country's going to die in less than 6 months. In 5 to 6 months, it's going to be dead. So this incident that I of listening to this man just confirmed it even more, that these people are lost, and they don't have the power to change anything because they're stuck in a very, very low level of understanding, no awareness of the truth. And just as a side note, I mean, I think shared this before in small detail, or in minor detail, but the thing that's been going on with this transsexualism that's going on, all this exposure of to little exposing little kids to all this stuff about gender confusion, and people say, oh, how this has happened, how has this happened, and out of nowhere this suddenly just took even more power and just dominates everything now. And one of the underlying reasons why that is happening is because, like, you just look at the American Christian Church. They have had gender confusion all this time. And what do I mean by that? Well, these people embrace these pastors as these men, leading men, when they are women. And these pastors pretend to be men, say, oh, I'm a man, I'm a leader. And I'm talking in a figurative sense. I'm a man, I'm a leader, when they are really just women. Women pretending to be men. They are spiritual transvestites. So women pretending to be men, and men who are turned into women by their teachings. So you have a lot of transvestites in the church sitting every day, sitting in the pews every day. And that's why we have it manifested in a literal sense in our whole society. These men are powerless. You listen to them talk and they're so effeminate because they are, you know, they want to portray this message of, you know, kumbaya and Jesus loves you and he's so nice and so kind and he was so giving and he was so understanding. You know, so it's they portray this God of weakness, of pathetic weakness. They're disgusting people, and I curse anyone who supports or blesses or endorses this pastor trash. It's a whole system of decay, matriarchal decay. And that's why the country's dying, because these people who should be connected to reality, to the truth somehow, are lost. And they're convinced in their illusion. They're not only deluded, but they're convinced in their delusion. And they refuse to listen to anything outside of their own understanding, because whilst they criticize, and rightfully so, those who promote the race politics and this race identity thing that we were talking about a moment ago, the mammon part, they have a mammon of their own, and it's their religion, their so-called Christianity. So if anyone questions the way they supposedly worship or follow their quote God, they feel like it's a personal attack. Like, oh, you don't attack my church, you don't attack my congregation, you don't attack my pastor. And if you say something about our Christian traditions or Christian values, the values that we've been taught and passed down through the ages, through the generations here in America, then you're speaking against me. Then it's like you're attacking me personally. So they completely reject it. And no, something is not true just because it's been taught in Sunday school or some preacher, or this is what the Christian tradition has taught. It's not, something is not true because it's true because it's true. And if it's true, then the truth will speak of itself. It's like, once you embrace the truth, you know the truth will speak through you. And people will hear and say, hey, there's the truth speaking. Then they can choose whether to embrace it or reject it. But there will be substance there. But to do that, you have to throw away all your mammon, everything that you identify yourself with, and say, no, my only identity is from the truth. You know, just like Descartes, he said, cogito ergo sum. He started with that. I think, therefore I am. It's like he got down to this fundamental truth, and he said, I'm going to build from there. And he said, I think, therefore I am. I am. And I am, talks about many things, but one of the things it talks about is identity, who I am. I think, therefore I am. So he was basically saying, I'm going to tie my identity to the truth. To this basic truth and build from there, and that's what these people, American Christians and Christians around the world, but since we're talking about America, what American Christians constantly refuse to do because they're tied to the mammon of their quote Christian religion, religious identity and religious traditions, and they don't understand that. If what they believe in, if the Bible is the truth, if their God is the truth, then if they stand by the truth, the Bible will stand on its own, and it will speak on its own through them, instead of them having to say, oh, it's in the Bible, like defending this holy book. When there's nothing holy about the book, if all you get from the book is surface understanding, it's just letters on a piece of paper, that's all it is. It's holy when it's in the truth. When you embrace it and you become intimate with the truth, then it's holy. Otherwise, it's just a piece of paper or a bunch of pages put together with a binding, and that's all it is. And it's meaningless, and sadly, these people do the same thing with the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, like this holy document. You don't speak ill of the Constitution. That's why I constantly call it trash and rubbish and all this, because it's just to emphasize to them, it's just a piece of paper and has a lot of mistakes, not a few mistakes. It just has a whole bunch of fundamental mistakes. It's badly written. It's like a poorly written eighth grade essay. That's how bad it is. But their identity, their mammon, is invested in that, in the greatness of the U.S. Constitution. So there's no talking them out of it. And their greatness is and identity is tied to, all their Christian traditions and all their Christian teachings. And I'm talking about what they've been taught, the traditions that they've been taught, the understanding that they have been taught. I'm not talking about the Bible per se, but I'm talking about what they understand from the Bible, their traditions, all these things that they get passed down that they just accept because it makes them feel good. There's a certain level of comfort in just sitting down and not having to think, just having ideas stuff into your head. You don't process them, you don't question them, you just receive them. And because everyone around you is of the same thinking, then you're right at home and you're in perfect harmony and you have a home. You have somewhere to be where you are embraced by the people around you. It's just a wonderful way to live. It's conflict-free. And the only problem is when you run into someone from another family who thinks differently from you. When these Christians run into the non-Christians, they don't know what to do because they try to convince them of their religion, of their faith, And then, you have to accept Christ. Yeah, because these are the traditions that I was brought up with, and they make me feel good, and I feel so special with, you know, believing in my faith and all this stuff. And the other people from the other family, you know, they've been comfortable with a whole bunch of other value systems and beliefs. And they go, no, because if I accept your beliefs, I'm going to have to separate myself from my family and join yours. But I already have a family. I already feel comfortable with my folks, with my crowd. So why do I need to change crowds? So we live in this world of families, in one family trying to convince someone from another family to join them. And the only argument to join their families, this is what we believe in this family, and it makes us all feel good. So come join us. And that's the message that all these Christian worthless churches preach all the time. You know, come join us and feel the love and feel the fellowship of being with amongst people who love you. It will make you feel good. So it's like saying, yeah, we have some perks in this family. Come join us. It's not that, no, this is the truth, and we're preaching the truth. You don't embrace the truth because it makes you feel good. Because oftentimes when you embrace the truth, it's just trouble ahead for you. It means pain and suffering and heartache, because sometimes embracing the truth means to suffer. Because most of the people around you are not going to embrace the truth, and you're going to have to be fighting on your own. It's a lonely battle. But they can't talk from that perspective because they are tied to their family. It's an effeminate, matriarchal understanding. People who promote family are effeminate people. Family values are values that tie you to your mother. It's matriarchal. Your home where your mother loves you and nurtures you and makes all the problems in the world go away when she hugs you and makes you feel good. That's family values. Values where you support someone because he's family or she's family, and there's a validity to that. Don't get me wrong. There's this fear of responsibility that we all have with the people around us, and the people around us usually are family. Well, not in my case, but you know, in the case of most people, the people around you are family. So you have a responsibility. But it's not a love, an effeminate love. It's a love that is based on the truth. So you love, and that love can come with judgment. You know, you love your brother, but your brother's an alcoholic. You're not going to condone his alcoholism and let him destroy himself. You're going to confront him. You're going to judge him and say, you are wrong in your alcoholism. Or you're going to confront someone who is stuck in a rut in traditions, and you're going to confront him with a vision. You're a visionary. You confront them. This is all you can achieve, and you're stuck in this routine and this rut. So you're going to call them to a vision, or you're going to help them to conquer things and achieve great things, and that means being aggressive, being male. So if you really love somebody, you're going to manifest manifest masculine love as opposed to feminine love, that is just make you feel good and make you feel comfortable. So the thing is that in our system, in our society, we have had this matriarchal understanding where people tie their values to different things, including family. That's their mammon. And everything is, believe this because our family believes it and it makes us feel good. I am digressing a lot, but I was watching a television show it kind of surprised me because, they have this black lady who's this character, this black lady, who is a Baptist, I think she is. And every now and then she talks about God in this comedy show. And she works with a doctor who is an atheist. So she's like the balance. And the show's not about religion or anything like that, but every now and then they mention God, or the doctor mentions the fact that he doesn't believe in God, but it's not like the theme, a running theme or a central theme of the show. But every now and then it comes out, and it's kind of interesting to have this black lady come out talking, defending God in some way, openly on a television show, a comedy show, because that's so taboo nowadays. This is a show from the 1990s, but even then it was not common. The thing is that one day, one of her co-workers asked her, why she believed in her faith, and why, and she said, "Why should I join your faith?" Because she was looking for a religion. So she said, "Why should I be a Baptist? Like, try to convince me to be one of your people." And she said, "Well, I believe in my faith because it makes me feel good." That's what the black lady said to the other lady. "It makes me feel good, and I take strength from my faith. And I feel this peace when I have this faith, and that's why I believe in it." And that was her argument. It makes her feel good. And she literally said it like that. It makes her feel good. And you say, "Oh, that's a television show," but believe you me, that's exactly what other people, maybe not literally, but and sometimes literally, but that's in essence what most Christians would have to say about their faith. If they're asked about it, I grew up, and she also mentioned, "I grew up in a Baptist family all my life, and my faith makes me feel good." But is that the proof that you want to give to people? "It makes me feel good." Well, some people say marijuana makes them feel good. So, are we gonna go by feelings here to see what's true and what's not true? That's why all these people, like Marxists, would say that religion is the opium of the masses. The opium makes you feel good for a while and kind of makes you forget reality. And that's basically the message, because again, it's not that they believe something because it's the truth and they are seeking a deeper acquaintance with the truth. They believe it because it makes them feel good. It makes them feel part of a family, in this case, the Baptist family, in the case of this lady. And it's not, "I believe this because it's the truth and I have seen as evidence in my life that what I believe in is true because of this, that, and the other." There was no substance to that. And I know this was a TV show written by people who may or may not have been Christians or Baptists or whatever. But it's a reflection of what happens in real life, because people have tied their identity to mammon, and the mammon manifests itself in many ways. It could be religion. It could be their ethnicity, it could be their patriotism, their nation. As a side note, and I think I've said this before, I've always found it so surprising how in America we are so happy with at least liberals, or in general, like on average. I'm surprised at how easy it is to find an American who hates America, and who has no problem with people burning the flag, and saying how evil and destructive and terrible the country is. And now I may be sounding like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm not. So please do follow me along for a second. And I despise that. I despise people who burn the flag and say all these bad things about America. And I say a lot of bad things about America, obviously, if you've been listening to these audio snippets, but not those things. Like America's this oppressive society. that's evil and destructive. Yeah, it's becoming oppressive because the Democrats are running things, but they're not talking about that type of oppression. They're talking about, oh, the white people oppressing everybody. And I go, well, okay, if this country is so oppressive, why are all these brown people crossing the border, the Rio Grande, and getting into the country any which way they can to find a better life? If this country is so evil against non-whites, why are all these non-white people showing up at the door and trying to get in and sneak in through the windows, through every, like rats, you know, through every hole they can find? Why are Cubans risking their lives crossing the 90 miles from Cuba to Miami if this country is so evil? So they criticize the country for the wrong reasons. And the irony is that if you took, for example, a Mexican, and if in Mexico someone dared to burn the Mexican flag, there'd be hell to pay. If someone in some sort of political power said something bad about Mexico, Mexico is a bad country, an evil country, that politician would die, maybe literally, but at least politically, they would die immediately. Mexicans are very, very patriotic, like excessively so, because they have tied their identity to their country, because they have nothing else to tie it to. They have nothing else to be proud of. I mean, they have had some achievements at the Latin American level, but other than that, you know, and maybe, you know, making tacos or something like that, they really have no claim to fame of anything. So they tie their pride to just being a part of that country, and they're very arrogant, very proud, arrogant people. Even at the with other Latin Americans, you can ask them, non-Mexicans, what they think about Mexicans. They'll tell you, how disgusting they are. They are very, very arrogant people, and they belittle their fellow Hispanics from other non-Mexican countries. But what I'm trying to say is, these Mexicans have tied their identity to their country, and they defend their country to the hilt from any criticism, any attack. I have never heard of a Mexican burning a Mexican flag. There's no chance in hell that's going to happen, at least at a major level, the way it happens in America. There's no way. I mean, whoever tried to burn a Mexican flag on the streets in Mexico would probably get lynched. A mob would gather around the guy, and they would beat him to a pulp or kill him. That's how arrogant they are. And they're proud and arrogant about a country that is so pathetically corrupt and decayed, so bad that they have to, constantly try to get into the U.S. because their country is such a piece of trash, of rubbish. And I find it ironic that in America, we have, all these people who hate the country, and no one else does it like that. But the people who do this flag burning and all this stuff, they do it because they found another family, the family of the liberals. And they feel comfortable in that family of self-hatred. Of white self-hatred. So they found another religion, and one of the tenets of their religion is to hate the country just for the sake of hating it. And then you have on the other side the conservatives, who just love the country, not in the deep obsessive level that Mexicans do, but who love America and love the Founding Fathers, love the Constitution, because that's their family, that's their mammon. They've tied their identity to that. So you have this contrast of how ironic that on the one hand, the people who are very obsessively patriotic are people who have tied their identity to a certain type of mammon. And then on the other hand, you have the America-hating liberals who hate the country for the wrong reasons because they have tied their identity to another mammon. You know, these people feel comfortable. It's just like this guy said in a certain way, mammon is a spirit. It's like these people feel comfortable with this rebel spirit. And it's a rebel in quotes because it's like, I feel like I'm part of the in crowd because I am questioning my own country. And I'm saying how bad it is. And then they look around and they see all these other people who want to join in the rebel label. And they feel comfortable. And it's the in thing to do. It's the cool thing to do to embrace all these ideas. So these people who claim to be rebels are actually conformists, you know, effeminate conformists, from the organizer and server personalities. It's conformist. There's no rebel in them. They would never dare be different from everybody else. They wouldn't dare say, no, what you're saying about America is wrong. America has its problems, but it's not this, that, the other, because they would get ostracized. In nowadays, if you say anything that goes against the liberal religion, you get attacked, you get ostracized. You get isolated and vilified and smeared and destroyed in every way possible. So it takes a brave person who is willing to be a real rebel to confront all these people. But the thing, what I'm trying to say is they have their own mammon. And it makes them feel good. It makes them feel hip. Like, oh, I can say I hate myself. Like all these white people who talk about white supremacy and white privilege and all this stuff, and I go, my goodness, I have never seen a race of people who are so self-loathing. Usually the problem with races is that they love themselves too much. But the white race has achieved this ability, this thing about finding identity in hating yourself, your own race, and it makes them feel good. There's something so noble to them about it. Oh yes, I'm showing how big of a human being I am by being able to criticize my own race and saying how evil the white man is and how much privilege the white man has and this and that, the other. And I always go in my head, okay, first of all, I don't know where you get this because you were indoctrinated with it, not because you had an encounter with the truth and you came to believe this, first of all. Second, if you really believe what you believe, and you say, for example, that the white man came and took the land away from the Amerindians, and then, you know, be a man, admit to the evil of your own race, and get the hell out of the Americas. Go back to Europe. If the white man was an invader to the Americas, what the hell are you doing here? You should be doing everything possible to get you and your family the hell out of this country and back to Europe where you belong. Because if your ancestors committed this grave evil of coming and taking over land that was not theirs, then why the hell are you still inheriting the land? So, I mean, put up or shut up. And if you're not going to put up, then shut up, admit that you're wrong, and stop promoting this nonsense. You know, it's like this song that I heard back in the 80s called Beds Are Burning by an Australian group. And the song is awesome in terms of music and everything, but the message is kind of crappy. And it says something like, how can we sleep when our beds are burning? And it said, we took their land, it belongs to them, we ought to give it back. And so he's basically saying, you know, we stole Australia from the Aborigines, and how can we sleep when our beds are burning? Like, we're living in this place, like sleeping on a bed that's burning, like living, like trying to live your life on a foundation that's burning. That's basically what I get from that. How can we rest on something that is not real or valid? He kept saying, you know, in the song, we ought to give it back. We took their land, we ought to give it back. So it's like saying, you know, do something about what you believe. And I would dare say they still live in Australia. I mean, the band, I forget the name of it, Midnight Oil, I think was the name of the band. I would dare say they're still living in Australia. So despite all their talk, I could be wrong, maybe they did move to the UK, but I would dare say that they didn't live up to their own message. But so we have this irony of people who hate their own race, but it's not proof that they have rejected mammon. It is it's just a manifestation of another mammon they have embraced. I guess we've been talking a lot about mammon, and I thought I was going to say just a few things about what this pastor had preached, but it's taken up the whole audio snippet now that I look at it, and we didn't get to 1876. Yeah, I'm sorry, but I guess it needed what we have said needed to be said. And it kind of I know I may sound like I'm exaggerating or making stuff up, but the 1876, that election was the 23rd presidential election in America. And the number 23, I've always associated it in my head with pastors or shepherds. And pastors or shepherds are very much associated with servers. You know, they are waiters and waitresses, servants, people who do service. So it's interesting that we've been talking about all this matriarchal stuff, people trapped in the server and organizer personalities. And we wanted to talk about an election, or we will hopefully be talking about an election that was the 23rd election of this country. And it was a very sad, sad election that revealed so many things. It was basically a continuation of what happened in 1874 when the Democrats took control of the House, barely 9 years after the end of the Civil War, as if we had not learned a thing. And then 2 years later, this election happened, and it kind of solidified the end of Reconstruction, saying the Republicans saying to black people, we don't care about you anymore. We're not going to help you out. Sorry, you're on your own now. And that's when we slid into this horrible racial hellhole in the South, where black people once again were, they were not officially slaves, but they were treated as such. And it was almost 100 years until hope came back, but in the meantime, the Republican Party remained mostly silent. And in 1876 was almost like the beginning of the end of that. 1874 was bad in the sense that the country voted in these evil Democrats into the White House after all they had done. And then in 1876, it's as if the Republican Party said, okay, we will go along with this betrayal, and we will betray black people and leave them to fend for themselves. And then we are surprised, and Republicans are surprised that Democrats flock to black people flock to the Democrat Party. And the silence the evil silence of the Republican Party, the laissez-faire attitude of the Republican Party when it came to black people, black America, kind of became signed in blood in 1876 as a result of this presidential election, which we will talk about in a future audio snippet. But because it's a lot to talk about, I believe it's better to leave it for another audio snippet. And it is sad that, again, we are 5 to 6 months away from the country dying, and there is no sign of change at any point. I still see examples of on conservative websites of people just holding on to their traditions and their ideas. Like, for example, I saw this headline shortly before this audio snippet about Bite Me. I'm going to read it. The headline, it's on the Citizen Free Press. It says, Biden tries to supersede all state laws with new federal Title IX rule on trannies. So apparently, I didn't really click on it, but it seems like Bite Me wants to pass this rule against the banning of gender confused people participating in women's sports. You know, men pretending to be women. Participating in women's sports, so he wants to override that. But the title of the, you know, the headline, you know, Bite Me tries to supersede all state laws with new federal title. So he's saying, oh, the state laws are protecting us from the decay, and there's now this new federal thing that's trying to come and impose on, like he's, so whoever the idiot who wrote this headline is basically saying federalism is good. Federalism protects us from all these crazy nut jobs. And on the surface, you say, oh, yes, the state laws are protected. No, but what is, but yes, state laws were also protecting slavery. State laws are protecting electoral fraud because it keeps, as we've said, we've explained this a million times, so I won't go into it, but the state laws are the ones that are protecting voter fraud because it keeps voter fraud localized, and you have to fight voter fraud at every state and fight the rules. Look at Carrie Lake in Arizona. She still hasn't won. And Katie Hobbs, the whore who stole the governorship from Carrie Lake, has just vetoed a law that they had passed in the Arizona legislature that had something to do with signatures, to validate the signatures, because there were a lot of fake signatures in all these mail-in ballots, fake ballots that were included in this stolen election of 2022. So she just vetoed it. As the so-called governor who stole the election, she vetoed this law to make voting more transparent. And because it's at the state level, there's nothing anyone can do about it, because state rights, state law protect Katie Hobbs doing that, and the Democrats, you know, keeping things corrupt at in Arizona. So state laws have been used to protect a whole bunch of stuff. So the problem is, it's not that there's a state law protecting us. It's not federalism that helps. The problem is all this other stuff that's going on, it has to do with other root issues. This transsexual thing, the root of it is everything we've been talking about in these audio snippets. The Christian church is a transsexual church. It's a church run by women pretending to be men, and men acting like women. That, and it's been like that for for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse. Because of in the past, it was we were covered by ignorance, you know, just like a little kid who doesn't know what he's doing. You know, a little kid, 2 or 3 year old, who's running around naked. No one says, "Oh, that's evil." The kid doesn't know what he's doing. But if he's 25 years old and he's walking around naked on the street, then, you know, there's a problem there. And that's what we have now. You know, a whole bunch of 25-year-olds walking around naked. Now it's a big problem. And that's why it spills over into society. Now we have all these gender-confused people, because the Christian church is a gender-confused church. So that's the underlying root of it. It's not federalism versus, you know, non-federalism. That's not the problem. So that's why I know this country is dead. And the issue with transsexualism is, how do you fight it from the constitutional standpoint? I challenge anyone on the face of the earth, any conservative, to say, prove to me that transsexualism is opposed to the Constitution, is contrary to the U.S. Constitution. I mean, can you at least, like, I'm not saying that, you know, the Founding Fathers had to put in a clause about transsexualism. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, are the principles, see, if you're on, the thing is, when you believe in the truth is, and your truth is comprehensive, if it's comprehensive enough, it will tackle anything. It's like, you know, when Euclid, and I've mentioned this before, Euclid was this Greek mathematician from a long time ago. I forget what century BC, but he was from a long time ago. He put together these postulates, and ironically, it was 23 postulates. Again, the number 23, these 23 fundamental postulates that he wrote down, and he built an entire geometry based on these postulates. Postulates are things that you assume to be true without questioning them. So he proved a whole bunch of stuff out of these 23. So there was a flaw in his, well, not flaw, but I guess it was a flaw in some of his postulates, but what I'm trying to say is he built this list of postulates and he built an entire geometry out of it because it was comprehensive enough to do the job. So Pythagoras' theorem can be proved through the postulates or based on while you're standing on the postulates. But Pythagoras' theorem is not one of the postulates. So the Constitution should be this list of postulates or fundamental principles. Maybe not postulates, but things that you can establish and put like lemmas or axioms and fundamental principles. And out of that, you can prove or disprove anything. You should be able to prove or disprove transsexualism from what's in the Constitution. If not, then your Constitution is not comprehensive enough. And it fails that comprehensiveness test so much that you have to conclude at the end of the day, this is a piece of trash. How can you build an entire nation, the foundation of an entire government system on this incomplete piece of trash? But I don't know if you go back to the earlier audio snippets, we talked a lot about concepts of race and gender and in the context of the new American Constitution. So if the Constitution had been written correctly, we would have enough foundation to attack or confront a gender confusion in a proper way, but we can't. But no one talks about going back to the Constitution and say, okay, what fundamental principle did we miss? And it's part of the reason why we don't do that in America is it's also tied to another quote spirit. This guy was talking about the spirit of Mammon, but there's another spirit that has been hounding us in a terrible way, and we will talk about it maybe in a future audio snippet, hopefully. I call it the P spirit or the E spirit. depending on what word you want to use to name it. And that's that attitude is what prevents us as a people going back to the Constitution and looking at fundamental principles that need to be changed or established in order to deal with things that are going on today. It's like we don't go to the root of the problem. Okay, what are we missing in our legal system and our government system? And to them, no, we don't have to worry about these deeper issues. Just have federalism so that we can pass state laws when we feel like it, supporting one thing or opposing another. But then you have all these states thinking different things. So if you live in the wrong state, you're going to be subject to oppression. So when he says this guy wrote superseding all state laws, then is he assuming that every state is against gender confusion? Well, obviously New York isn't, New Jersey isn't, all these other liberal, California clearly isn't. So this guy is saying, well, it's up to the state. So if you live in California, then and you're a female athlete, I'm sorry, but there's nothing we can do about it. So this is the limited thinking of these people. And that's why I know the country is dead. We're not learning a thing. And time is running out. But running out in the sense not that, we need to tie the score. We're down by 72 points and time is running out. The game is over. Just like a cancer patient, the cancer has metastasized. We're just waiting for the time of death. That's all we're waiting for, and it will happen in 5 to 6 months. And yes, hopefully we will talk about the 1876 election in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.